I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, State of the Union Day, 23rd of January. A reminder, we are carrying the State of the Union address, 8 o'clock this evening. President Bush will be delivering his speech. The Democratic response will follow. You will hear that. And then post-speech analysis will be carried by NPR. And then tomorrow morning, we're going to get a lot of analysis, starting with Joy Cardine at 6 o'clock. My first hour will be devoted to an analysis of what he has to say, and Ben Marins will be dealing with analysis as well. This hour, we asked the question, actually our guest has asked the question, what if the president gave a State of the Union speech and nobody tuned in? In his press briefing last Thursday, the White House press secretary, Tony Snow, warned that that just might happen tonight. A lot of times these speeches, they just go on and you lose people, he said. So he promised that this year's speech is not going to be a typical State of the Union address in the sense of going at great length through all the budget items. Instead, the president will address major issues, including the war on terror, not the war in Iraq, energy, health care, immigration, and education. That's the first paragraph of an online piece in the New Republic that was posted just yesterday, actually. And the author, who has a lot, who knows an awful lot about writing speeches for the president, because he was chief speechwriter for former President Bill Clinton from 1992 through 1994. David Kusnet is with us. He writes on political rhetoric for the New Republic Online. His article, Words Fail, appeared in the New Republic Online, posted yesterday. And he has a new book coming out. We'll have to talk to him about that. Love the Job. No, got it mixed up. Love the Work, Hate the Job, which is forthcoming. And so we'll talk to him about that. We're welcoming your phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. What do you hope the president will talk about tonight? And do you plan to watch? Do you plan to listen to the address? Hi, David.
Hi.
Hi. Did you ever write a State of the Union speech?
Well, I worked on several of them for President Clinton.
Are they hard to put together?
They are very difficult to put together. They, with President Clinton, they took up a lot of his time. Not just writing and rehearsing, but I'm sure him thinking through what he wanted to say. And a lot of the White House staff and a lot of the staff in the cabinet agencies is involved in it, because it's almost like a corporation's annual report.
Yeah,
it's a report on what the federal government under the president's leadership has tried to accomplish during the past year. It's a report on what the condition of the country is in the view of the president. And it's a report on where the president wants to lead the country in the future.
Mm-hmm. So what about you? I love the first line of your piece here. What if the president gave a State of the Union speech and nobody tuned in? Is that likely to happen? I mean, obviously, we're going to watch it. But is that likely to happen? He's not going to have much of an audience here because people are not listening to him much anymore?
My guess is, I mean, he'll have a substantial audience, as he should. My guess is that it will be less of an audience than President Bush and most previous presidents have had in the past. What I found interesting was that the White House press secretary, Tony Snow, actually mentioned the possibility that either that not that many people will be listening or that they'll be listening at the beginning of the speech and might tune out before the speech is over.
Mm-hmm.
It's not at all unusual for president's staffs to say some of what Tony Snow said last week, to say that this year's State of the Union speech isn't going to be, and they always use this phrase, it isn't going to be a laundry list, they'll say. It's going to be thematic, visionary, forward-looking. It's not unusual for a White House staff to be saying that. What is unusual is for White House staff, especially the press secretary, to be so forthright as to admit that people just might not tune in or might tune out on the president's speech.
Mm-hmm. Or we'll be tuning in to, as we were suggesting the last hour, watch Senator Clinton and Senator Obama and Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic response and the Republican response to some of what the president will say. So we're looking in terms of reaction instead of what the president's saying.
Yeah, I think that might happen. I imagine that there'll be some interest in what Senator Jim Webb has to say
as
the Democratic response, the official Democratic response to the State of the Union.
Why did they pick him, do you think, David?
Well, it's the second year in a row that the Democrats will have picked someone from Virginia. Last year, the Democrats had Governor Tim Kaine of Virginia. I think part of it is reaching out to the South. Part of it is the fact that Jim Webb has such an impressive military background. He was Secretary of the Navy under President Reagan, and he's a decorated Vietnam veteran. Mm-hmm. But I think part of it also is that he's a professional writer. He's a novelist.
Yes,
he's a historian.
Very good, isn't he?
And he writes his own, you know.
Whoops, hello. He writes his own, and we lost him. Oh, darn. Well, we'll get back to the end of that sentence in a moment. I'm not sure what happened here, but hello? No, I don't know what happened. He just lost the line. And we'll be welcoming phone calls as well. We were talking about Senator Webb giving the Democratic response. Do you plan to watch tonight? And what about the themes that the president will take up? We'll be talking about that as we reconnect with David Kusnet. David has a piece. You may want to go to it. It's an interesting one, The New Republic Online, How Lame Will Bush's State of the Union Be? Words Fail is the title of the article. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655.
Hello?
I don't know what happened.
Hi, I'm sorry we were cut off somehow.
I know. Well, I'm glad.
I was talking about Senator Webb.
Yes, you were.
And why he's of such interest.
Right.
I maybe repeat what I was saying, but he's a professional writer. He's a novelist. He's a historian. And he's known for writing his own, the words that he speaks, and being authentic and honest, and saying what's on his mind. I think there'll be a great deal of interest in what he has to say.
Yeah, exactly. Who's writing for the president right now? You talk about his speech that he gave on Iraq. It was just awful. Whoever wrote it or coached him ought to be fired, because he was, you know, it was hard to figure out who this guy was all of a sudden. And you talk about having lost the chief speechwriter in January 2005. It makes me believe that the speechwriter is very important here, because whatever we saw last speech from the president just wasn't very good. Hello? Man, where did we keep losing our guest? Hello? David? Hello? I don't know what's going on, but we keep losing our guest. So we will reach him again and try to figure out what's happening here. I'm sorry, everybody, but we'll work it out here in a moment. We wanted to hear his response. I don't know if you had this similar reaction to the president when he gave his speech about the new direction for Iraq, that it was a different kind of president. I was wondering about who was writing for him there, because it just didn't seem to be terribly inspiring. He didn't seem to be real genuine for that speech. He's given very good speeches, I think, but that certainly wasn't one of them. So the importance of the speechwriter and the themes that he will be discussing tonight as well. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And we're just experiencing a few technical problems here. I'm not sure what's going on, but the line is we can't get through to him. The line is just not with us, all right? All right. So we'll reestablish connection, and let me just take a few phone calls, and then we'll get David back on the line. Hi, Rich from Rhinelander. Help me out.
Well, I'll help you out. I almost feel as though I've jinxed you, Kathleen, by calling in. But I will watch the speech tonight, and I'll watch it because I listen and watch to all presidents, whoever they are.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a hip and leg problem, so it'll be therapeutic for me. I'm certain I'll be numb by the time the thing is over. But I do know how President Bush should conclude his speech tonight. And the way he should conclude it is by announcing that he's going to immediately issue signing statements that we shouldn't pay attention to anything that he's told us, because it may impede his ability to behave as a chief executive officer of what he considers to be a business, the United States of America, rather than a free democratic republic. This guy is so filled with lines that are fed to him and smoke and mirrors that I really think he should have some dry ice around the bottom of the of where he's speaking. So billows of sort of prom dance clouds float by him as he speaks to us. I I don't trust the man at all anymore. Mm. I really don't. I think he doesn't even trust himself. That speech on Iraq, the surge forward, seemed to me as though I could see right through him and how shallow he was perceiving even himself to be.
Are you going to listen to the Democratic response? Are you happy with who the Democrats put up as the response speaker, Rich?
I think Jim Webb is an excellent speaker, and I think he's gaining there's increasing credibility for Jim Webb with the American people because, first of all, he's sort of a newcomer to a certain degree, and he also has the credentials where people will say, let's see if this person is real, just like we're now saying about Barack Obama, and just like people are saying about Hillary Clinton, that we doubt that she's real, that she's had so much of a history behind her. I think Jim Webb benefits from his newness to in the minds of the public, that let's see how he speaks to us and whether he makes sense or not. So, yeah, I'll definitely pay attention to everything that's going on. But I agree with you completely that the Iraq surge forward, the new way forward speech,
was terrible, wasn't it?
They shouldn't have even allowed President Bush to appear that way in public. I think, if anything, if I were a soldier in Iraq, that would undercut my confidence in all kinds of things. I just thought he was very ineffective.
I was surprised by that one because he can be effective in his speeches.
Yes.
But there was something about the delivery in his face, and it was such an important speech for him as well. It was so important.
After 9/11, he was very effective in some of the very simple things that said. And your listeners may also be interested in a piece on Salon.com. It's about conservative word doctor Frank Luntz, who is very disappointed in the rhetoric coming out of the Republican Party at present. And he basically, the title of it is How to Speak Republican. And he's been a speechwriter for President Bush. And he really thinks things have really taken a dive downward for the Republicans.
Mm.
So.
Thanks very much, Rich, for the call.
Yeah, okay.
And I think we've linked. Yeah, thanks. I think we have him on again. David, I'm really sorry. I'm not sure what's happening. This has never happened to me before, but are you there?
Yes.
Oh, thanks, David. It's good to hear you. We were talking. I just went to a couple of phone calls, but we were talking about the president's speech on escalation of the war and wondering who wrote that speech and why it was so ineffective and why it was delivered the way that it was. And it was such an important speech for the president. What went wrong there, do you think?
It may just be one speechwriter protecting another or protecting a bunch of them, but I would be very surprised if the problem was the actual work of the speechwriter or speechwriters who worked on it.
Mm.
It sounded like something written by committee, which is almost always worse than something written by one or two people.
Mm-hmm.
The president's speechwriter now is a man named William McGurn, who has had quite a career in journalism. He was an editorial writer for the Wall Street Journal. He was, editorial page editor for the New York Post, both of which are very conservative newspapers. And he worked for William Buckley's National Review for quite some time.
Hmm.
So he's had a long career in conservative journalism. He replaces someone named Michael Gerson, who's much better known, who I think had a lot to do with helping to create the President Bush's voice as a plain-spoken, the way that he presents himself as being a plain-spoken man of faith who is decisive and in touch with the American people. I think Michael Gerson, who also had a journalistic career at U.S. News and World Report and worked for several Republican senators and is a sincere and committed evangelical Christian. I think Michael Gerson had a lot to do with creating that voice, for helping to create that voice for President Bush. And William McGurn, I wrote an article about it on the New Republic website, I think about 2 years ago. I think his natural voice is probably much more argumentative than Gerson's.
Mm-hmm.
That that may have mixed results for the president.
Now, that's interesting. And what about the president's natural voice? Are they all different when it comes to what's coming from their heart and their head that they definitely want to convey? Do some presidents just give it over to the speechwriter and thus we don't get a consistent idea of what's in the president's heart?
Well, speaking of the president that I knew and worked with, President Clinton certainly did not give over anything to the speechwriters. He, in fact, never had, when he was governor of Arkansas and before that when he was attorney general of Arkansas, and well into his presidential campaign in 1992, he never had anyone on his staff as governor or in his presidential campaign until June of 1992. His title was speechwriter. President Clinton is as well known as somebody who can get up in front of a crowd, not only without any text that someone else helped to prepare, but without a text that he himself prepared, and speak extemporaneously.
The guy can talk, right?
That's right. He can speak perfect sentences, perfect paragraphs, perfect pages about any number of subjects.
Yeah. What's your thought about what the president's going to say concerning the war on terror, the war in Iraq? From what I've been reading today, he doesn't plan to spend much time talking about Iraq, and yet I think the American public want him to talk about Iraq.
Well, my guess is that whatever you or I or the audience to this program may have thought about his speech about Iraq 2 weeks ago, that he figures he's given his Iraq speech. And my guess is that he won't devote more than a few paragraphs to Iraq. He'll probably talk at greater length about the war on terror. One technique that he's used in his speeches in general, especially with his State of the Union speeches, has been to embed the more controversial things that he does and advocates in the less controversial things. Mm. So his method has always been, when talking about the war in Iraq, that first he'll talk about protecting the United States against terrorism. Mm-hmm. Then he'll talk about the war in Afghanistan. And both of those situations are much less controversial than the war in Iraq. And then, having gotten you nodding in agreement, then he'll talk about the war in Iraq. He does the same thing on a lot of issues. He does it on taxes. First, he'll talk about what he claims are tax cuts that he's offered for middle-income and low-income Americans. And then and only then will he talk about the tax cuts for the upper-income Americans. So his rhetorical technique has always been to get you to talk about the areas of agreement before he talks about the areas of disagreement.
We're going to welcome more phone calls for David in just a moment. David Kusnet is our guest. He has a piece in the New Republic Online, Words Fail, which is his comments on the State of the Union address and what we're likely to hear and likely not to hear from the president this evening. We're also talking about the Democratic response and whether or not you'll be tuning in and what you would like to have the president address. David was chief speechwriter for former President Bill Clinton from 1992 through 1994, and he has a new book coming out. We'll book him for this book when it comes out. Love the work, hate the job. 800-486-8655. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's welcome more phone calls. And I do want to remind you that the presidential State of the Union address will be carried tonight on the Ideas Network. We'll also have the Democratic response. This starts at 8, and then we'll have post-speech analysis tomorrow morning. A lot of analysis, starting with Joy Cardine. My first hour tomorrow will be an analysis of the president's address and Ben Maron's show in the afternoon. So you'll have a lot of chance to talk about what you hear tonight and see tonight. Back to phone calls. Mary from Eau Claire is our next caller. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi.
Unlike Rich, I do not plan to watch this tonight for the reasons that he gave. First of all, I can't stand to listen or watch him. Can't trust him. His words, he can't even speak English properly. Shallow, done a disastrous job. I don't think we should give him the satisfaction of paying attention to this any longer. And tomorrow will be a painful day also as we rehash and go over everything that he says and give him even more attention on this. So that's just my comment. I know there's lots of people who want to call in. So
thanks, Mary. Thanks for the call. David?
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I think the last caller sort of confirms the point that Tony Snow made last week, mm-hmm. and that I tried to make in the mm-hmm. New Republic web piece, that there's likely to be less of an audience for the president tonight than for most Day of the Union speeches.
Yeah. Is there anything he can do? I mean, you get this feeling the poll numbers are down the tubes. People don't like him. They don't like the war. What initiatives do you think he might be able to present to us tonight that may revive his presidency?
Well, I think what they've signaled that he's going to try to do is try to, after 6 years of not doing this, try to engage the Democrats in some effort at working together on some domestic issues where there might be some common ground. I wouldn't be surprised if he uses the phrase common ground.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he has mixed prospects on the different issues. On education, I think he's going to try to work with the Democrats to renew the No Child Left Behind
mm-hmm.
law, which provides greater federal assistance for public schools in return for their meeting certain standard. And now I'm sort of lapsing into policy jargon, in return for their meeting certain standards of the kids doing better as measured by standardized tests. And that was passed in a bipartisan way in 2001. He worked with two leading Democrats, Senator Kennedy and Congressman George Miller, who's very close to Speaker Pelosi and is now chairman of the House Education and Labor Committee. That law has become much more controversial
than might
have been expected
mm-hmm.
over the last few years. And it's controversial across the board. As someone said, the Democrats maybe don't like some of the rigid standards, and the Republicans don't like federal involvement in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
So there's
And the teachers don't like it at all.
That's right.
Yeah.
So there's liberal, conservative, and teacher, and some parent, and PTA, and school administrator opposition. So it's sort of controversial across the board. The question is whether he can hold his own party and get some Democratic support and find some way to have a policy that I think there at least used to be some general agreement for, that the schools ought to get more resources, but in return they ought to produce more results. If there's some way to do it without the cumbersome and bureaucratic testing requirements that are in place now. That's one issue. I think he'll try I'm certainly not a supporter of President Bush, but I think he's functioned in good faith on No Child Left Behind, even though I don't agree with a lot of what he's done. I think he'll try to function in good faith there, and I think there's a possibility that the Democrats and Republicans in the administration might be able to come up with something that they all can live
with.
On the environment, I think a big question actually is rhetorical. He's going to be proposing, I think, some measures for energy conservation and alternative fuels. I think a big question is whether he presents it mostly as a conservation and climate change issue or mostly as a national security issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think in order to get a real commitment, there has to be some recognition that in addition to the very real national security implications of the dependence on foreign oil, that there's also a real environmental problem.
Mm-hmm.
And if he doesn't recognize that there is global warming, that it is produced by human activity, then there's not going to be the kind of urgency to do as much as should be done there. So it'll be interesting to listen to the rhetoric of what he says as well as the substance of what he proposes.
Right.
I think on health care, I think he's, and this is a serious thing to suggest, but I think he's serious. I think he's consciously proposing something of a non-starter. This idea of taxing what he calls gold-plated health insurance plans to provide tax benefits for presumably lower-income people buying what would probably be bare bones health insurance. I think he must know that that's a non-starter, because what he seems to be doing is lumping together what may really be some gold-plated health insurance plans with the kind of health insurance that unionized industrial workers have, which
mm-hmm.
isn't gold-plated. It's something that they bargained for, that they want at the bargaining table in return for for not getting the kind of wage increase that they would have gotten otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that you have working class families around the country, not as many as there should be, but some that enjoy decent health coverage for the wage earner and for the wage earner's family. And that's something that's been won over the years, really starting in World War II when it was difficult, when there weren't wage increases, but there could be increases in health coverage. So, and it's something that's been won at the expense of wage increases and other kinds of gains. And just go for somebody from his background of privilege, just to go after that as if it was some kind of unfair advantage that ought to be taxed away. I think that is and should be a non-starter.
Yeah. You wonder, don't you, David? There are certain kinds of issues, and I think that health care is one of them. It's not a partisan thing here. When you've got as many people without health insurance and this huge disparity between, you know, cancer rates for those who are minorities in this country and those who aren't, and access to preventative programs and to treatment programs, it broaches on being sinful. And it seems to me as though if this president took hold of this issue in some way and could forge ahead with a plan that would help the people who are uninsured, that would help the businesses who are really hurting on this issue, he'd be a hero to a lot of people. I don't for the life of me understand why it's so hard to address this issue.
I agree. I think he and his staff ought to take a look at what Governor Schwarzenegger, who's a Republican,
right. Yeah, yeah.
is doing in California, even at what Governor Romney did in Massachusetts. I mean, they made good faith efforts to reach out to Democrats as well as Republicans in their legislatures and pass something that everybody could live with. I mean, I think there's really a growing consensus in this country among business, labor, consumers, senior citizens, that we just have to do something to cover everybody
mm-hmm.
under health insurance, and also that the burden, instead of demonizing these insurance programs, the burden should be eased on the companies that are doing the right thing and providing good health care for good health coverage for their workers and their workers' families. I mean,
mm-hmm.
as a lot of people have said, both business and labor and others, we're the only country in the world that puts cars and other manufactured goods on the market and wants consumers overseas to pay for the costs of regular medical checkups for the workers' kids.
I mean, right.
Our products and our companies and our workers just have an unfair burden around them when they're competing in the international marketplace because we don't have a sensible universal health care system
right.
in this country.
Yeah, it's kind of nutty. Steve from Richland Center, hi.
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 Often presidents will use the State of the Union address as a way of touting their accomplishments. Is there, David, can you think of anything that this president can name as an accomplishment in the past year or even the past 6 years?
Well, as I said, I'm not a supporter of his, so I'm sure someone who is a supporter would take a more optimistic view of what he's accomplished. I think that he'll try to point to the economy as a success, and that might indicate the ways in which he's not quite in touch with most Americans. You can point to a relatively low official unemployment rate, and I think he thinks that that should make people happier than it does make many people, because there's a problem that he doesn't acknowledge, and in fairness, a lot of Democrats don't acknowledge either, which is that productivity, which is work, and I'm going to lapse into policy jargon again. I apologize.
It's all right.
Workers' productivity has become unlinked with workers' wages. The people are working much harder and much smarter than they did before, but they're not getting real wage increases that they've earned by doing that. So you also have a lot of insecurity. There's a lot of churning in the job market. Even if the unemployment rate is low, a lot of people are in fear of losing their jobs. And what's worse, to go back to what we were talking about just a minute or two ago, is people who have decent health coverage are afraid that if they lose their job and get a new job, they're going to end up with much worse health coverage than they had when they started out. So there's a lot of insecurity out there that can't be measured by the unemployment rate. And if the president gets up tonight and starts boasting about how great the economy is doing, it's not going to correspond with the ways that a lot of people think about the economy.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, what looks best on paper about the country's situation isn't quite as good as the president may be tempted to take credit for.
Mm-hmm. Why are his approval numbers so very low? We're getting reports today that they're, you know, they're as low as Nixon's were during Watergate. Is it the war, David?
Well, I think the war is a big part of it. That you have, there have been other presidents with unpopular wars. President Johnson and President Nixon had the war, had the war in Vietnam, and people were not happy about the war, and they were not happy about the way the president was handling it. But they had both, to a certain extent, inherited that war.
Mm-hmm.
With President Bush, you have an unpopular war that he began, and that he began, I think it's becoming clear, as a war of choice, not mm-hmm. a war of necessity. So, in a sense, he is facing something much worse than Presidents Johnson or President mm-hmm. Nixon faced with the war in Vietnam, or certainly than President Truman faced with the Korean War. That he has an unpopular war of choice, and it was his own choice.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, the problem of the economy, that there's much more, as we were saying, there's much more insecurity than can be measured by the unemployment statistics.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, while it only directly affects a region of the country, I think Hurricane Katrina also really did a lot to damage the esteem that the American people hold for President Bush, because a lot of his presidency has been about hyping crises that may or may not really have been crises.
Hmm.
But here you had a real crisis, a real natural disaster, and his administration was so inept at handling that crisis that I think it really called into question his competence at doing other things and the extent to which he's in touch with the way the American people live.
So, and it falls on the backs of the New Orleans Saints to give people hope about reviving that city, right?
That's right.
It's kind of weird.
Nancy
from Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi.
Hi,
how
Nancy.
How are you today?
Fine. How are you?
Good. At first, a comment on how my husband and I have watched States of the Union in the past, and then I do have a question for your guest. But pre-children, we always enjoyed them with a cocktail in hand and a little bit of heckling, no matter who was in office. And certainly the in recent years, there's been a lot more heckling. But now that we have two little kids, I don't know if we're both going to be able to sit down and watch it, but I hope to. But my question is, or I would like the guest's comments and thoughts on the format in recent years, where the presidents have a parade of the common citizen strewn throughout their speech, or the soldier, or the family from the heartland,
mm-hmm.
which to me just seems very rote and so set up,
mm-hmm.
and I can't believe that they really think that the American public buys that.
Right, I'm with you on that. It's so contrived, isn't it?
But I would really appreciate to hear his thoughts on that,
okay.
And I will take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Nancy.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's a good point. The having the regular citizens up in the gallery as the president's and first lady's guests. That began with President Reagan, I think, in 1981 or 1982.
Hmm.
And it had a good reason for beginning. There was, I think, right before, I forget if it was either 81 or 82, but right before one of those State of the Union speeches, there was a terrible snowfall in the Washington area.
Hmm.
And for some reason, planes were still taking off and landing in National Airport. And one of them crashed.
Oh.
And tragically, a lot of people were killed. But at least one was rescued by a federal worker who jumped into the freezing water.
Oh, yes, I remember this story, yeah.
And saved
I think
one or more passengers from the plane who were in the freezing water.
Mm-hmm.
And I happen to remember the man's name. I should pay tribute to him. His name was Lenny Skutnik. He was a federal worker.
Huh.
And President Reagan, as he should, congratulated Lenny Skutnik, who was not just a great American, but a great American who worked for the president. In fact, he wasn't a political appointee for the president, but he worked in the federal government.
Hmm.
And he had him up there in the gallery, and he paid tribute to him. And I think he used him as an example of the kind of public-spiritedness and self-sacrifice that, you know, we all should try to display in our own lives. And that was a good thing to do, and that made sense. But then it became a technique that President Reagan used every year, and I think every president has used it every year or almost every year since then.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost expected, as if it was some kind of constitutional requirement now, that the president has to have some guests in the gallery who exemplify the virtues and accomplishments and ideas that he's advocating. I remember President Clinton himself did that. But I remember he also, with his staff, he used to have a phrase that sticks in my mind that showed that he was sensitive to it. He used to say, don't use people as props.
Mm.
And I remember he used to say that sometimes in great frustration when people would come to him with some idea of how to stage manage some kind of event. I mean, he was sensitive to the fact that people have a dignity and you shouldn't just point them out as being victims or even heroes, you know, as if they were inanimate objects that some powerful public figure points to.
Yeah. Oh, that was it. I didn't know all this background. Oh, we got to pause for a moment and we'll return. David Kusnet is our guest. Read his online piece, The New Republic. It's Words Fail, How Lame Will Bush's State of the Union Be? And just a reminder that we're carrying the State of the Union tonight, so if you're driving around or if you'd prefer to listen to the speech or if you want to go between television and radio because you're in different parts of the House, we will not only have the speech, we'll have Senator Webb's Democratic response and also provide the post-speech analysis. And then tomorrow morning, starting with Joy Cardine at 6, we will be analyzing the speech for a good chunk of our talk shows tomorrow with Joy and my first hour, and then with Ben Marins. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. David Kusnet was chief speechwriter for former President Bill Clinton from 1992 to 1994. He has a book coming up. It'll be published soon, Love the Work, Hate the Job. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to your phone calls now. Jeff from Arborvita. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning to you, David, also. I guess I should preface my comment also with a couple of callers prior to mine in saying that, you know, it's definitely difficult to sit through a speech given by President Bush. It almost borderlines on comical at times. Although the question that I have for you is, I was just kind of curious, not only referring to President Bush, but presidents in the past as well, how much of the content in that speech is he responsible for? I mean, is it something that he has advisors on? I would imagine he certainly does. But the actual content of the speech itself, how much of that would he actually be responsible for?
That's a good question, David.
Speaking of the president that I worked for, with Bill Clinton, the content ultimately was his own. He would think through what he wanted to say, how he wanted to say it. And much of the writing took place in what they called preparation sessions, where he'd be up at the podium and the writers and others would be sitting there taking notes and running tape recorders, and then we'd transcribe and edit what he had said. And one of us said that we were probably the highest paid stenographers in America. So I mean, that's the way President Clinton worked. I would assume that with President Bush, certainly the ultimate responsibility for the ideas, for the arguments, is his. I mean, other people can write things, but ultimately the president has to decide if that's what he wants to say and if he's comfortable saying it that way. And especially with the State of the Union speech, in terms of staffing, there are so many people who have a hand in it, writers, policy people, people in the cabinet departments, that in a sense there, too, the ultimate responsibility is the president's, because he's the one who hired all these people, and he's the one who gives them ultimate direction, and he's the one who even determines what their relationship is among each other and whose word carries and whose word doesn't.
Well, is he the kind of president, do you know this, David, who will spend a good portion of today and maybe the last few days brushing up on the speech, changing it, fine-tuning it?
Well, he does. I mean, no one on the outside can know for sure what goes on in the inside, but it does seem that he is. They talk about him having rehearsal sessions and practice sessions. They talk at the end of last week, which didn't usually happen within our administration, of the speech being finalized already. So you do get the sense that while he doesn't seem that facile with words in spontaneous settings, that words do matter to him, and the speech does matter to him, and that there is quite a process that goes into arriving at it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jeff, for the call. We go next to Ron from Madison. Hi, Ron.
Thanks. I'm cautious about listening to politicians because they are professional liars. In my draft of Baby George's speech tonight, there are only three paragraphs. First, apologize to all humans and other living things on this planet. Second, abdicate as Earth's evil emperor. And third, to order the FBI and U.S. Marshals to extradite war criminals. That is, everybody who's still living, who's ever served as U.S. president, vice president, in the cabinet, in the Congress, or in the Supreme Court, should be extradited to the World Court of Justice in The Hague. We could ask them to leave Condi Rice in charge through February and then replace her with some other cabinet secretary for March so they could have an acting president to keep things acting like a country while the trials go on in the Netherlands.
Oh, there's so many people who really don't like this president, David, obviously.
Well, that's true. I would have to take exception to what the previous caller said.
Mm-hmm. You want to go further and talk about why? Or?
I think if I heard him right, he said that every previous president was a war criminal, and I don't agree with that.
Thanks very much for the call, Ron. We go to Lois next from Wausau. Hi, Lois.
Hi, good morning. I have a little bit of a different perspective, unlike some of the earlier callers who say they won't be watching tonight. This is the first State of the Union address by Bush that I will be watching. Unlike previous years where there was excessive fawning and clapping, undeserved, in my opinion, I've been waiting a long time to see Democrats sitting in the powerful seats, and I can't wait to see what happens.
And I would imagine that a lot of the press coverage will be on, as we were talking about earlier, you know, Senator Clinton, Senator Barack Obama, Nancy Pelosi, et cetera. It'll be interesting to see and whether or not people are clapping or they're standing or are they sitting on their hands. What are they doing? I think there'll be a lot of that tonight, David.
Well, one thing that's going to be very interesting is for the first time since the last year of President Clinton, when you have the two people sitting behind the president, one of them is going to be a Speaker of the House from the other party.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always interesting what the body chemistry is between the president and the Speaker from the other party.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be especially interesting because for the first time in this country's history,
Speaker
is going to be a woman, Nancy Pelosi.
Right.
So there is going to be a Democratic woman sitting behind President Bush as he speaks, and for the first time in history, the face of the United States government that we present to ourselves and to the world is going to include a woman in the third ranking position in the United States government, third in the line of succession to the presidency, or second in the line of succession.
It's really quite significant.
After the vice president.
Isn't it, David? It's a big thing.
It is.
Yeah.
And I think it's really going to dawn on people for the first time this evening, emotionally.
Yes,
I think, you know, people who follow the news know that there's a Democratic speaker and that speaker is a woman. But so far, she hasn't been in quite as visible a position as she'll be this evening. She'll be sitting right behind the President of the United States when he reports to the Congress and the country on the State of the Union. And I'm not sure about the camera angles, but I think it'll be very difficult to get a shot of the president without having her in the background.
Right. I think they want her in the background. It's a better camera shot tonight.
Right.
Yeah. 800-486-8655 is our number. David Kusnet is our guest. David was chief speechwriter for former President Bill Clinton from 1992 to 1994. We're talking about the president's State of the Union speech, which we will carry tonight at 8 o'clock, and he is the author of a piece. You probably want to, you know, get yourself ready for the speech, you know, have your soft drink or whatever, sit down and read David's piece before you listen to the president. Words Fail, it appears in the New Republic Online. It was posted yesterday. And we go next to Mary from Baraboo. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
Hi.
I will not be watching Bush. I don't trust him. I think he lies. And if he were to bring up the economy being so wonderful, I would be absolutely livid because, in my opinion, it isn't good. They've created jobs, but there's a lot of minimum wage jobs. There's a lot of poor. There's people uninsured, and he has done nothing to help the people. He just feels he is right no matter what he does. And I can't watch him. I can't use the word president in front of his name. I mean, he just makes me a very angry, embarrassed American. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, David.
Well, I mean, I agree very much with the last caller, and I think what she was saying illustrates why the president, why President Bush would be ill-advised to take too glowing a view of the economy. We're, we're at a point where the official employment statistics do not measure a lot of things about most Americans' well-being. They measure if you have a job, but they don't measure how much the job pays. They don't measure how secure the job is. They don't measure if you have health coverage and what kind of health coverage it is. They don't measure if you have a pension plan that you can count on. So for him to if he gets up tonight and just claims credit for a low official unemployment rate and does not show any understanding of the texture of people's lives, I think it's not going to do him, it's not going to serve him well.
Yeah. Obviously, we will have you on talking about this in a more complete fashion. Give me just a brief synopsis of the book, Love the Work, Hate the Job, coming out soon. What's it about?
That book it will be about workplace conflicts in today's America. And the thesis is that with the economy changing, a lot more people are in careers that they've chosen for themselves because they think it's a calling in life, whether someone's working as a teacher or a nurse or, to pick some of the occupations that I'm writing about, a aircraft engineer or someone who writes computer software, tests computer software. A lot more people are in work that they basically like and work that they've chosen as their calling in life, or maybe even think that they were that's the calling that chose them. So they love love may be too strong a word, but they like the work that they do. What they're much more ambivalent about is the conditions under which they do their work. In other words, their job, and not only their wages and benefits and pension benefits or lack of pension benefits, but also whether they have the resources and the discretion that they need to do their best work. If you're a teacher in the class and you have an unmanageable class size and you don't have the kind of equipment that you need in the classroom and the school's breaking down, then even though you love to teach, you're frustrated by situations that make it more difficult for you to teach. The same with a nurse or another hospital worker who has just, you know, if they, you have to treat too many patients in too little time and you don't get the support and the resources that you need, and the hospital management, the HMO, is saying that the patients can't get the treatments that they need, then you're frustrated about whether you can do your best work. And what I do in the book is I tell the stories. I hope I'm not carrying on too long.
No, it's fine, David.
I tell the stories of some workplace conflicts that took place in Seattle, Washington, in the year 2000. There was a strike by the engineers at the Boeing company, which was the largest strike in American history by professional workers in private industry. There were problems faced by the temporary workers at the Microsoft company, the people who write and test the software that most of us use in our computers. I write about an organizing campaign at a hospital in the city of Seattle, and also about a lockout, the management preventing the workers from working, in effect a strike by management, at a company that used to be a model employer, the Kaiser Aluminum Company in Tacoma, Washington, and elsewhere in the state of Washington. And some of your older listeners may remember a man named Henry Kaiser, who was considered a model progressive industrialist in the 20th century, and whom Franklin D. Roosevelt once thought should have been his successor as president. And he set up a company where he realized that working in making aluminum was one of the most difficult and dangerous jobs in the world, so he tried to treat people right. He gave them an hour of nap time every day at the factory.
Oh, that's
they were the
great
only
idea.
Blue-collar workers in America who got sabbaticals. Every seventh year, they got a paid 6 months off.
Yes.
And eventually, the company fell into other hands after Kaiser died and after his family sold the company. And it ended up locking out its own employees in 1999. So that's one of the stories that I tell.
When's it out, David? When's the book?
It should be out at the end of this year from the publisher John A. Wiley.
Uh-huh. Great. Well, will you do an interview with us again?
I'd be glad to.
Right. Thank you so much for being with us. Have fun tonight.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to eat chocolate cake and watch the president. You know, you got to have something to go with it.
That's right.
Right. Thank you. Appreciate your being with us.
Well, thank you. Good talking to you.
David Kusnet, he is the author of a piece. It's in the New Republic. If you'd like to read it, it was posted yesterday, and it is titled Words Fail. And it looks at the president's State of the Union address and what's likely to be covered and how many people will be watching it and all of that. David was the chief speechwriter for former President Bill Clinton from 1992 to 1994. His book sounds great, doesn't it? We'll have to talk to him about that as soon as it's released later this year. Love the work and hate the job. Just a reminder, the president's speech will be carried here on the Ideas Network, the State of the Union address, 8 o'clock tonight, including the Democratic response from Senator James Webb and also post-speech analysis. And then tomorrow morning, starting with Joy Cardine at 6 a.m., a lot of analysis of what the president has to say. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for booking this hour and under trying circumstances, because the guests that we were to have had yesterday, well, today during this hour, looking at war and several presidencies, got very sick. So Carmen had to book something late yesterday afternoon. And it was a heck of a good guest, don't you think? I've had a really good time here this morning, I must say. Thanks to John Treader for being with us as well. Until tomorrow, this is the Ideas Network.